Right, good evening. We are now facing the Sukkot festival, which is going to be happening tomorrow night with the help of God. And we will be dwelling in Sukkot and shaking the lulav and esrog. And so we have on the first page over here from Parshat Emor in the Torah, where it speaks about the festival. And it's actually quite extensive what the Chumash, what the Torah says about Sukkot. It begins on the previous page, which we haven't got here. Maybe if we begin with verse 39, Ach b'chamisha asa yom l'chodesh hashvi, but on the 15th day of the 7th month, ba'os b'chem et tvuat ha'aretz, when you gather in the produce of the earth, tachogu et chag Hashem shivat yomim, you should celebrate the festival of God for 7 days, b'yom harishon shabbaton u'b'yom hashmini shabbaton. The first day will be a festival and the eighth day will be a festival. So here we have the idea that there's 7 days and yet there's an eighth day, because the eighth day is actually Shmini Atzeret, which is not really part of Sukkot. So you have 7 days of Sukkot and then the eighth day, which is called Shmini Atzeret, the eighth day. And now, talking again about Sukkot, it says, "Ulekachnim lachem b'yom rishon." You should take for yourself on the first day, meaning the first day of the festival. And the Midrash comments, "It's the first day of transgressions." Why is it the first day of transgressions? Because Yom Kippur, we were atoned for all our transgressions. And between Yom Kippur and Sukkot, we were so busy, we didn't have time to do any transgressions, as Nicole will substantiate. Then, the first day of the festival, now we can sing. We're relaxed. We built the sukkah, everything's there, now we can do something wrong again. But so you should take for yourself, but of course we won't. You should take for yourself on the first day pri eitz hadar, a fruit. Now this word hadar is usually translated as beautiful, like the word hidur. In fact, here the translation just says the fruit of the citron tree. It just gives the name of the fruit, the etrog, the citron. And here we have a citron. One of the ways the sages explain this word, hadar, it's a strange word, hadar. And,
is that where neda comes from?
Neda?
Neda.
Yes, that would be a possible way. Yeah, beautiful. Saying beautiful. But the way the sages take this word, hadar, is they read it as a verb. Hadar, which dar means dwell, like dira. Yeah, a flat, an apartment. So hadar bi'ilono mishana l'shana. It dwells on the tree from year to year, because the etrog, the citron, is a very unusual fruit in that when it grows, it just continues to grow. And if you support it so that it won't fall off the tree because of its weight, it will actually grow very large, and it'll grow for several years, getting bigger and bigger.
Really?
Yes. And I've seen an etrog as big as a rugby football. You know, and that's this idea of the way it goes through the different seasons of life. It's like a person, you know, there's the winter, there's the summer, the winter, the spring, the autumn, you know, all these different things. And from each of these different vicissitudes of life, it grows. It grows in the winter as well, you know, so even when things are negative, it's growing from that too. So that's the etrog. So pri eitz hadar. And then it goes on, kapot tmarim. Now kapot tmarim means the palm branch. I'm just going to put this over here, and let's see if we can unhook that. Yes, just a couple.
So Danny, push that on a bit further. I'm worried about the pattern.
Yep, thank you.
I hope you've got a fit on this one.
Yes, so here we have the kapot tmarim, that means the palm branch. It's a young palm branch, because when it grows older, these leaves spread out. So they spread out into a typical palm frond. But at this point, they are close together, and that's what it's saying. Kapot. Kapot means like a hand clasped.
A fist.
Clasped palm branches. So that's what this is. And then it goes on. Va'anaf eitz avot. And a branch of the tree which is thick. Avot. It's thickly covered by leaves, and the tradition is that means the hadasim, the myrtle. These are called the myrtle, with their three leaves. It's very hard to find these, actually, and this relates to the economics of the lulanestric setting. So these, they have to have three leaves in a group at each step up the stem. And so, and that makes a kosher hadas. And of course, there are many hadasim which are not like them and aren't kosher. So, one has to look for the kosher.
Why have you got seven, three?
Well, I mean, one way, the Talmud said that's the species. But in fact, you find in the same bush, you find some with three and some which are, I'm not sure if it's really in the same bush, but they seem very similar, are others where it's two and then one and then two and one. And the point is that it's got to be this with three. And of course then comes the whole mystical dimension about, you know, the different meanings that are there in these different plants. And one of the simple basic concepts is that each plant expresses the unity of many things together. So the fact of the three being together at each step, and then that means that the stem is more or less covered by leaves. That gathering, that clustering of the leaves together, that's the way that the myrtle expresses unity. The lulav expresses unity by the fact that the leaves, which could be separate, are in fact bonded together. And the etrog expresses unity in the way that it goes through the whole year and all the different vicissitudes of the seasons. And the willow, which is the next plant mentioned in the verse, va'anaf eitzav, va'ave nacha, willows of the brook, like weeping willow, the willow which grows near the near a river. So they often grow, the Talmud says, gedelim ba'achava, they grow in a brotherly way. There are always lots of willows together. You don't find, you know, like one willow. It's always lots of them together. So that too expresses this sense of achdut. Usamachtem lifnei Hashem elokechem shivat yamim. And you should rejoice before Hashem your God for 7 days. V'chagotem oto chag l'Hashem shivat yamim b'shana, and you should celebrate this festival for 7 days in the year, chokat olam l'dorotechem, an eternal statue for your generations, b'chodesh hashvi, in the 7th month, this month of Tishrei, tachogu oto, you should celebrate this festival. B'sukot teshvu shivat yamim. In Sukkot, then we have the other aspect of the festival. Here is the lulav and etrog, but there's also the idea of the sukkah. You should dwell in Sukkot for 7 days. Kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael yeshvu b'sukkot. Every citizen in the Jewish people should dwell in a sukkah. Leman, now this is a very significant and interesting verse. Leman yedu dorotechem. In order that your generation should know, Ki basukot hoshavti et bnei Yisrael, that I made the Jewish people dwell in Sukkot. We're going to ask what Sukkot are in a moment. When I took them out of the land of Egypt, Ani Hashem Elokechem, I am Hashem your God. And then Moshe tells this to the Jewish people. Now, what are the Sukkot that we dwelt in? So one opinion is huts. Huts, I mean, that, you know, that's what most children are taught in Cheder, let's say. Yes, in Hebrew class, huts. They lived in huts. In fact, we don't find huts mentioned in the description of the Jews in the desert. You often find mention of their homes, which are tents, not huts. And, you know, so does the word sukkah mean a tent? A tent is something different. We think of a tent as being something a bit different. So there's another opinion in the Talmud. What is the sukkah? The sukkah, Anthony?
The clouds.
The clouds. The clouds of glory. The clouds of glory which surrounded the entire Jewish people wandering through the desert, and they were covered by a kind of a canopy of cloud. A rather spiritual canopy in a sense. And that is what we represent with the sukkah. And that's why the making of the sukkah has such subtle concept. The roof of the sukkah, the schach, which is the key part of the sukkah, is made of something which cannot acquire impurity, which is very interesting. In Jewish thought, there's the idea of pure and impure. Some things can acquire a purity, so if they're made impure, they become impure, like a cup. So a cup could either be pure or it could be impure. But there are other things which can't acquire impurity. So a branch which has been cut from a tree, or, I mean, the tree itself, but if you cut the branch from the tree, still, that branch cannot acquire impurity unless it's made into something. If it's made into a spoon, then it will acquire, then it's an object, and it's got a hollow, it's a receptacle, and it's a vessel. But before it's a vessel, when it's just a rough branch from a tree, and even if you did smooth it a bit and sandpaper it, it still counts as a non-vessel, and as a non-vessel it can't acquire impurity. So there's that concept of the schach of the sukkah, which is a special kind of material which cannot acquire impurity. It's things that grow from the ground, have been cut from the ground, and have not been made into a vessel which could then acquire impurity. So there's this sense of purity about the roof of the schach, the roof of the sukkah, and that relates back to the clouds of glory in the desert.
Can you just explain the link between impurity and like something being a vessel?
I think that once it's a vessel, it's part of our like real practical world, and because it's part of the real practical world, it can now, it's in a position that it could acquire impurity. So for example, if it was in a house and then there was a corpse, unfortunately, in the house, so that would make that vessel acquire impurity. So the way to get rid of the impurity is to have the ashes of the red heifer, which are then sprinkled on it, which is a whole complex procedure, none of which we do today, and that's why we consider most things and most people in some way impure. That's why we can't walk onto the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, because we consider ourselves impure. But
I never knew that. So the Temple Mount is prohibited for ourselves.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So
for all time.
Well,
until such time as.
Well, I mean, if it was an emergency of some kind, you know, like what you'd call pikuach nefesh, you know, if soldiers had to go on the temple. But in normal terms, a Jewish person wouldn't go on the Temple Mount. When Mashiach comes, we will then have the red heifer purifying us, and then we'll know how to deal with the Temple Mount. Yeah, that's. So now the discourse is going to talk about the nature of the sukkah, the nature of the four plants, the lulav and etrog, in relation to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which actually was touched on in the discourse last week also, which began off about Sukkot, then it focused on Yom Kippur. So this discourse, which was said at a different time, this is the discourse from 1979, Tafshin Mem 5740. So 1979, and it was said the 13th of Tishri, which is today, which happens to be the yahrzeit of the Rebbe Maharash, Rebbe Shmuel, the fourth Lubavitcher Rebbe. So there was very often a Hasidic gathering on this night, just before Sukkot, in which, or the previous night, in which the Rebbe would talk about Sukkot. And so there's quite a few discourses relating to Sukkot from this. So we will so it begins by Sukkot Teshu, it quotes this verse. Oh ya 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 yam bam 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 ha yam bam 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 yam bam yam bam bam yam bam Sukkot teishvu shivat yamim. In Sukkot you should dwell for 7 days. Kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael yeshu b'Sukkot. Every citizen in the Jewish people should dwell in Sukkot. V'hatam al zeh, and the reason given for this is leman yedu dorotechem, in order that your generation should know. Ki b'Sukkot hoshavti et b'nei Yisrael, that I made the Jewish people dwell in Sukkot, v'hotzi otam me'eretz Mitzrayim, when I took them out of the land of Egypt, etc. Tzuguzon. Umiloshona katov, and from the expression of this verse, leman yedu, in order that they should know. Shira, do you want that? Yeah. In order that people should know. The meaning we learn, shiadiyazu, this knowledge, hilorak inyan b'chavanat ha-mitzvah, it's not just an aspect of the, like the intention within the mitzvah. You know, there's kavanot, there's, you know, so you might feel that any mitzvah that you do, there's some aspect of focusing your attention and thinking about it, which is part of what's called the kavanah, concentration, focusing on doing the mitzvah with a particular sense of the meaning. It's not just that. Eina chelek b'kiyum ha-mitzvah. It's actually part of the keeping of the mitzvah. Now that's a very interesting thing about a sukkah. You can't unconsciously be in a sukkah and fulfill the mitzvah of sukkah. You could unconsciously, according to the Talmud, you could unconsciously eat matzah on the night of Pesach, and you're fulfilling the mitzvah of eating matzah. The Talmud gives an extraordinary situation of this weird group of bandits who have captured someone, and they force feed him with matzah, and it happens to be the night of the Seder night. And he is considered to have fulfilled the mitzvah of eating matzah, because he ate the matzah, it was real matzah, it was the right time, and he ate it. And he did it even though he didn't think that it was a mitzvah, and he wasn't thinking about the mitzvah, but he did it. The same thing about a woman who's supposed to go to the mikveh, and she is sailing in a boat, and she falls out of the boat into the water. She's not thinking about going to the mikveh, but it's considered as if she did go to the mikveh. However, with the sukkah, we actually have to know about the sukkah. So we have to realize that this is a sukkah. So it would be quite possible to rig up a kind of, a sukkah environment. But if people don't know it's a sukkah, then they haven't actually fulfilled the mitzvah, because the mitzvah is to know. And that's why there are limitations. How high the sukkah can be, can't be more than 20 cubits high, because the idea is if it's more than 20 cubits high, you don't notice the roof, and so you won't think about it. So the whole focus on knowledge. So awareness. The sukkah is something to do with awareness. The awareness is actually part of the mitzvah, as is written in the Shulchan Aruch.
Is shofar in the other category? If you're passing somebody blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah, you happen to hear it, even though you're not thinking about it, have you fulfilled the mitzvah?
Well, that's an interesting discussion in the poskim, the halachic authorities, because you're supposed to have in mind that you are hearing the shofar as the mitzvah of shofar. Now, what happens in modern Jewish life? People say, "Are you coming to shul?" They go to shul. Oh, there's the shofar. they're not necessarily thinking about the shofar. But the way that modern halachic authorities put it is that the initial idea of going to shul is all with the awareness that Rosh Hashanah is a package and the shofar is part of that package. And so even though they're not actually, they might be very engrossed in some conversation just at the moment when the shofar is being blown, but they do hear it. But because the reason why they're in shul is because it has to do with the shofar. Mm-hmm.
It's possible to find it's possible to find other mitzvahs where you have to be aware. It's not unique in that way. I was thinking of saying over things at the Seder.
You
have to be aware of what it's about. The mitzvah of Sukkah, Yetzias Mitzrayim.
Well, the mitzvah of telling about going out of Egypt is actually, that's a mitzvah in itself.
Something where
saying the Shema, the first line of the Shema, Ad Kan Mitzvat Kavana, and Mikam Ve'elach, it's the mitzvah of Kriya. So there's when you say the words Hero Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. One is supposed to have in mind what that means, that it means that God is one. But after that, person prays every day and he says these words day by day, it may be that he goes onto automatic pilot and he's worrying about how he's going to deal with his boss because he keeps coming late for work, whatever it is. So he moves into some other thought, but his mouth is saying the words, so he doesn't have to say those words again, and ideally when he says the Shema, that moment he should be focusing on it. So that's benching, Birchat HaMazon, we're supposed to be aware of, supposed to focus on. Okay, so we have the idea of knowledge. Now knowledge in Kabbalistic and Hasidic terms is like a trigger word, knowledge. Because knowledge means a whole process. You see, you have let's see how we can if we express wisdom at this high level. Now wisdom is like a point of inspiration, you could say, and then you have further exploration of that wisdom, which is understanding. So there's Chochmah and Bina, And then comes knowledge that, so this is a certain level of, it's somehow it's come from this level, it's come into knowledge, and now it's got a level of meaning and commitment and reality. So knowledge is a very powerful concept. So Chochma Bina Da'at, and then after that begin the other levels of the Sfirot, underneath that the different Sfirot ending up with kingship. So knowledge is a very powerful concept in Hasidic and Kabbalistic terms.
It's interesting, a lot of people would, if you gave it to them, I bet you a lot of people would put their arrows the other way around. First you get the knowledge, then you understand the knowledge you've got. When you've understood the knowledge which you've got, that's called wisdom.
That's the English use. That's the English usage.
That's the English,
you know, in terms of how the English language normally works. Mm. Here we're trying to apply these terms to translate Hebrew concepts. Mm. And as Hebrew concepts, it's working the other way around. Wisdom, perhaps wisdom is an inappropriate word for chokhmah, but in so many senses, you know, the chacham, the wise man,
means an idea.
But in this sense, it's the initial, it's the starting point.
Yeah, the inspiration.
It's the inspiration. It could be, let's say, a passage of the Torah. So here you have a passage of the Torah which we just read. So that is the basic substance of wisdom. That is this inspired text, right? This is a text which comes from Moses, from Moshe, transmitted from God. It's actually a divine text. And so when we look at that, that's wisdom on a very ethereal level, but it's like the yud of the divine name. It's a drop, or sometimes it's described as a lightning flash. It hasn't been expressed. Then we have understanding, writing a dalad instead of a hey, so as not to write God's name. But that is a broadening. That's a broadening of the whole concept. And then knowledge is what bonds this into the next step of the vav and the hey. And that knowledge is bonding, like in the phrase, Adam knew Eve, literally translating, Adam yada et chava, he knew, it means they made love together. But that intimacy, that is the bonding of knowledge. And that bonding within one's own mind, that is the bonding which is taking these deeper, more exalted levels into the sort of practical reality of one's being. So knowledge implies this transition to a more practical and more real dimension of thought, experience, and existence.
Just out of interest, where's the other hay?
Well, then we have Vav, which is the Sfira. And then hey, the other hey is malchut, is the divine kingship, the feminine principle. So that flows through into the feminine, which is the other hey.
So no, and knowledge, like da'at would be like sort of.
Well, da'at is
the child, it's the offspring.
It's generating the offspring. It's you have this. The Vav K, you see here's the letter Vav, and then we have another Dalet instead of a He, which is like, so we've got Yud and He and Vav and He, and what bonds them together is that quality of Da'at, which actually joins them. And in a way, the Yud and the He, see, there's a way of writing it with the knowledge, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge in the middle, bonding them together. That's another way of writing it. So instead of being in a straight line, wisdom's on the right, understanding on the left. The knowledge is in the middle, connecting those two and connecting them to the lower dimensions. So it's a connecting.
In that sense.
It's containing and connecting.
So in this conception, knowledge is an active principle.
Yes.
Knowledge is not the offspring of wisdom fertilizing understanding.
In a way, it is the... It comes from that, and yet it is more...
It's also a condition for that.
Yes.
So it's circular. Very interesting how circular it is.
The way we're explaining it...
See, knowledge...
Knowledge is internalizing all that. The way you explained it, the wisdom is looking at a verse in the Old Testament, and understanding is seeing a deeper meaning, and knowledge is becoming so intimate with it that you know it inside out.
Internalizing it.
Yeah.
Here, putting it, wisdom on the right, understanding on the left, and Da'at in the middle, knowledge in the middle, that reaches up to the very highest levels, beyond. And it's because it is able to reach up to that higher level beyond that it's able to act in this way of drawing these two together and then drawing them into the lower realm. Okay.
It's a circular, he's right, it's a circular process. In a way, after you've internalized it, you go back.
Well, yeah, except that from the knowledge comes eventually the action in the world, the effect of that knowledge in the world. Yeah. It's commitment, it's being dedicated, it's caring. Now, the gun. Okay, we're doing well over here. We've got to the sixth line.
Excellent.
The gum, at this point in the discourse, it's like asking questions. You know, what do all these things mean? What's the significance of them? The gum, mahu basukot teshvu, what does it mean you should dwell in Sukkot? Hare sukkah hu b'chinat makif. A sukkah is something surrounding. Now, thinking of things in terms of radiance and vessels, you got the radiance which goes into the vessel. And knowledge is something like that, you know, something which is in, which is within, like you say, internalizing. That's exactly what Da'at is. It's this internalization process. Whereas the sukkah is something around the person, makif, a radiance which surrounds the person, which isn't internalized because it's beyond internalization. It's too intense to be internalized. It's too bright. It's too radiant. And in order to hide its radiance, it might be concealed in darkness. There's a wonderful discourse that I'm learning in the Kutei Torah where it talks about like successive levels, light and dark. You know, and as you're at a certain level which seems dark and the higher level is light, or it could be that the level you're on is light, it's revelation, and then the higher level is dark. But when you get to that higher level, that is light, and then the level beyond is dark, you know, and so it goes higher and higher, successive radiance and darkness, and so all the time there's a level of darkness beyond. Or it could all be read the other way around, and the darkness is lower enough. So, but this sense of something which cannot be contained. And the sukkah is like an expression of godliness which cannot be contained. It's just too much. And so therefore it's this surrounding, like the clouds in the desert, the clouds of glory. The clouds express the presence of the divine in this most incredible way. You know, like you couldn't get over that. It's just wow. You know, it's, whatever happened, you know, you woke up in the morning in the wandering in the wilderness during, you know, year 27 of leaving Egypt, and you know, there are these clouds and the pillar of clouds and the pillar of fire at night. So, wow, look at this. Just think where we are. So the sukkah represents something which is makif,
Ve'ininityashvut, and then we're told we have to sit in the sukkah. Sitting. Take this word sitting seriously. What does it mean to sit? Sit means hityashvut. There's this nice word in Hebrew. It means being settled. Ulomit yashev. You know, he's not a settled personality. You know, so to sit means that the person is sitting and is settled and somehow is absorbing this infinite radiance which is surrounding him or her. That's like a paradox about the sukkah, that there is a sukkah of surrounding radiance, and then we have to somehow draw that within us. So all that shayach bevchinat pnimiyat dafka. So that would mean, so you should dwell in the sukkah, is like saying you have to take the surrounding radiance of the sukkah and make it internalized, which is how do you do that? The fact it says it in that you dwell in the sukkah, muchach, this shows shegam la'achrei ha'yeshiva, even after you have settled in this, you're sitting in the sukkah, you've somehow taken this surrounding radiance and you've internalized it, but nonetheless you're still in a realm of makif. So you see, you have the sukkah. That red line represents the sukkah. And here is the person who is somehow sitting there, and that in that sense is internalizing this radiance, right? So it's being internalized. But the radiance hasn't gone away. There is still this surrounding radiance. So maybe he's internalizing this level, and then there's yet a higher level. These are the plural, basukot, in this sukkah, in that sukkah, in that higher sukkah. So all the time there is a sense that whatever is being internalized, there's always a higher level which is beyond internalization. So there's a higher. Okay, gam tzorich lahavin. Now another point that we have to understand. Ma shekatuv kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael yeshvu b'sukkot. Why does it say every citizen in Israel should dwell in Sukkot? Hare ha'tzibui b'sukkot yeshvu hu l'chol Yisrael. It's already told us every Jew has to sit in the Sukkah. What's it adding here that every citizen should sit there? And then various other points that it's... that it learns out from this, and now we come to the line beginning Vehine. Have you got that? Just over halfway down. Vehine, mi pasuk ze. Now from this verse, Kol ha'ezach b'Yisrael yeshvu basukot. Every citizen of the Jewish people should dwell in Sukkot. Lemeidim, we learn, footnote 8 tells us where it is in the Talmud, Tractate Sukkah 27b. Dechol Yisrael ru'im leshev besukkah achat. The Talmud suddenly comes out with this extraordinary idea that the whole Jewish people should really, that's the way, ru'im, you know, like a fitting to, you know, should dwell in one sukkah. It suddenly comes up in the middle of this Talmudic discussion that there's this enormous, enormous sukkah, and all the hundreds and thousands or millions of the Jewish people are sitting there in the same sukkah. They're all there in the same one sukkah. So there's this. So even though in practice there's never been such a sukkah or anything like it, but the idea that in some sort of sense we should all be in one sukkah. That's a very interesting concept. You know, and the Talmud sort of like throws that out, but based on a verse in the Torah. The Talmud says this is what the verse means. Every citizen in the Jewish people should sit in Sukkot, and the Talmud takes it. You could argue with the Talmud, you know, it means every citizen should sit in their own sukkah. It means a million sukkot.
But the Talmud understands it as meaning every citizen should sit in the same sukkah.
So, Tali, just to clarify for us, when it says the Chol Yisrael for him l'sheid b'sukkah echad, is that a passage from the Talmud itself?
Yeah, that's a quote from the Talmud.
Direct quotation from the Talmud.
Yeah, that's a direct quote. Yeah, and it gives the reference, Sukkah 27b.
Yeah.
You see, and it quotes it, it says this, based on this verse. What's the, it's Talmudic exegesis?
Yeah, it might be because it follows the idea that the Sukkah represent the clouds, these clouds of glory. And all of Yisrael were under one.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Like you said we weren't ever, but they were, I guess.
Well, in that sense, the paradigm of the Sukkah, the ideal of what the Sukkah is supposed to represent, exactly as Anthony says, are these clouds. So it's one single huge Sukkah that everyone was in. Yeah, that's a very good point.
One covering.
Yeah, one covering. We weren't in little separate clouds. It was all one big cloud.
Seems to be an idea of unity.
Absolutely.
In the same ways you keep mentioning to do
with the
lulav and esrog.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the way we read it here, can it be construed? I understand that the use of the language says we should all be in one sukkah.
Well, ru'uyin is an interesting word. It would be fitting. Ra'uy means fit for something. So ru'uyin kol Yisrael, it would be fit for all Israel to dwell in one sukkah.
And can we then extract from this the view that when we are in our different sukkot, we constitute a single assembly?
We could think of it that way.
So then
because the idea of the sukkah is
it's a unifying
paradigm, you know, in its paradigm, is one sukkah which unifies everyone together. Therefore, even though we're in different sukkot and even in different countries, we are all
under
being unified.
Under God's single covering.
That's true. Yes, yes. And we're therefore all being connected with each other. Mm. Because it's the whole Jewish people who are dwelling in this one sukkah together. And so we are connected not only with God because we're keeping a divine mitzvah, but also with each other because the whole Jewish people are together in a sukkah.
Yeah.
Is there not also Talmudic commentary on Yom Kippur as a moment in time when all the Jewish people are together before God?
That's an extremely good point, which we're going to come to here, and was also mentioned last week.
Yeah.
The idea that the sukkah relates to the cloud of incense in the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. So that's another dimension of cloud, and that's another aspect of the sukkah.
Yeah, it's very central. It's a good point. It's very central to Yom Kippur, isn't it? Everybody coming together.
Mm.
The point being that if a person just prays by himself, he's got certain attributes and certain faults. And so is the guy next to you in the synagogue, and so is the guy next to him. Mm. But if you're all taken together, well, that's the way I've seen it explained. If you're all taken together, so all the attributes are taken together. Mm. So therefore, you're quite right in what you say. It's an absolute necessity to daven as part of a congregation. Everybody should be unified. Mm. I think how this is brought out in law, which is interesting in Jewish law, is that the chazan who davens on Yom Kippur, so I don't want to go off on a tangent, but I just seem to remember this, there's a special din on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, that the chazan who davens, if anybody says, I object, this guy owes me £100 and he never paid me, you know, and who does he think he is going off davening in front of us on Yom Kippur? Then the halacha says, well, he should stand down, and somebody who everybody's happy with should daven it for everybody. But it's this same thing. Everybody should be happy with the person doing the prayers, that everybody should have this unity, particularly on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I don't think this doesn't apply any other day, does it?
I think you're supposed to approve. The chazan is always a shliach tzibur. You've just explained one of the reasons for the proliferation of synagogue.
No. I'm saying, this halacha about objecting to the chazan. No, I'm right. I'll tell you just a minute. Oh, you mean that's what everybody goes to start with?
You know, the man on the desert island with his.
This thing I just described with the chazan, that only applies on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I'm right, aren't I? Well, it's mentioned in Halacha to do with that. Rosh Hashanah.
But there is that beautiful meditation for the Musaf on Rosh Hashanah.
How humble I am as the Baal Musaf. Yeah. But I thought you were going to mention another thing, which is at the beginning of Kol Nidre, it is announced that in the yeshiva, the upper yeshiva and the lower yeshiva, it's permitted to pray together with the transgressors, with sinners. And normally these sinners, unfortunately, I mean, if you take, you know, the medieval Jewish community or something, there were people who might have been doing very, very serious negative things. And as a result of that, they were banned from the synagogue. Nowadays, being banned from the synagogue.
Like a burglar.
wouldn't be much of a celebrity.
Yossel Ganef. local burglar.
But in those days, there was nowhere else to go. And so people were very upset at being banned from the synagogue. But when it came to Yom Kippur, they would be allowed into the synagogue. And that is like the incense, that the incense has 11 ingredients, one of which had a bad odor. And nonetheless, it has to be part of the incense. The ingredient called chelbana in Hebrew, translated as galbanum, although I've never actually, you know, found a shop which sells galbanum, you know, to know what it really looks like. But this galbanum was, or chelbana, is supposed to have an unpleasant smell, and nonetheless it's part of the incense, and that relates to the sinner in Israel who is also necessary.
That's a lovely idiom, that something that smells bad, when you mix it up together with all the other things which smell good, it actually makes it smell better.
I always find it a bit confusing when we talk about, like, sinners or this or that, you know.
Sinners,
because, because it doesn't really make any sense, does it? Because, everyone is a sinner, you know, to some degree. But, we are, you know, you can't be perfect. And as much as we'd like to, we aspire towards a certain, we're all sort of to some degree a sinner.
Well, it depends how you hear. Let's say you've got this an opening prayer on Yom Kippur. So the chazan is singing over there, you know, behold we permit that the sinners can join us. So one person thinks, ah, that means so and so can join us. The other person thinks, ah, that means that I can join in. You know, you're right. We can look at ourselves as sinners, and there's an aspect of us where we are sinners. That's our own ego in the face of the divine and our egotistical approach. On the other hand, sometimes there are, you know, more serious things that we do, and this concept of breaking through the limitations and everyone actually being connected together is a very, very deep concept. You know, that's despite the attempt. Now, that relates back to the lulav and estrog, incidentally, because the estrog has a scent, it smells, a fragrance, and it tastes, because you can make the estrog into a nice jam after Yontem. And the date palm has dates, which you can eat, but no fragrance. And the myrtle has a fragrance, but no taste. And the willow has neither fragrance nor taste. And taste is described in the Midrash as meaning Torah knowledge. And fragrance are the observance of mitzvot. So the etchog represents both ideals, the combination of both in an ideal way. The lulav is Torah study. The myrtle is mitzvah, which is very good, but the willow is neither. And nonetheless, they're all, it's like four different parts of the Jewish people, but they're all together in the lulav. And if you didn't have the willow in the lulav, you wouldn't be able to make a blessing
and the lid.
I read in one of the Masorim that the origins of the consent given for us to pray among sinners derives from the Sephardi world, where people were forcibly converted.
Well,
and it was on Yom Kippur that even the false converts were able to join the congregations.
Well, we never had a rule against converts joining
the congregation.
We never had a rule forbidding them from doing that. It was a Marano who would come to a synagogue was in terrible peril for his own life from the Inquisition. The Jewish people would never stop him coming. Unless it might be said that they were trying to persuade him to come back to Judaism. There was a famous attempt by a rabbi whose name has not come down to us in the time of Maimonides, the time of the Rambam, to say that people who'd converted to Islam shouldn't be allowed into the synagogue. And the Rambam wrote a very, very vigorous condemnation of this view, and said that even if someone has converted to Islam, he still should be allowed into the synagogue. And, you know, so there was a blanket view that...
of inclusion.
Yes, of inclusion. I think that it's more specific things where the Jewish community have banned people as a way of...
Like Spinoza or...
It's interesting, So these sinners, they came once a year on Yom Kippur.
I've never really read a proper study of that. But you see, the Kol Nidre prayer, I've heard, again, you know, not really looking into it properly, but the whole reason why we are making such a fuss about cancelling vows is because the Jews in Visigothic Spain were forced to take vows saying that they would never keep Judaism. They were forcibly converted, and they had to remain Christians, and they had
at
to
risk of their life, yeah.
Yeah, and they had to take vows saying that they would have nothing more to do with Judaism, and so this is where they are saying these vows are cancelled.
Yeah.
Oh, so maybe that's what I'm confusing.
I went to
a lecture. It's very interesting about the Maranos. I went to a lecture by somebody who actually went out there and found some of the Maranos still and took them to matzahs for Pesach, and it was interesting. He told all about the aggravation, you know, when they tried to come to the synagogue, and the people who are there now, who are Jewish, they say the Maranos, they were not they didn't want to give them an aliyah and shul, because they said they're not secret Jews, they said they're Christians. So you're right, in a way, there was this. But this was fairly recent.
Well,
there was, you know,
500 years later.
I'm talking about a guy who was standing speaking in front of me, and he'd five years ago and tried to
introduce them to each other. It is an attempt which is taking place of discovering Murano people or groups of people and
helping them find a way back.
Yeah,
but it's it's fraught with all kinds of difficulties, and including actual proof that the person is really
Jewish.
You know, in the female line. So it's a complicated issue. You know, it's a simple thing. It is taking place at this point, It's one of the many complications that the Jewish people are involved in.
Oh, you mean the people who want to be Jewish? You mean they want to be Jewish?
Well,
whether they are.
Well, yeah, it's a complicated issue. Exactly how
you mean they might have to convert?
There are all kinds. You know, how exactly the Rabbonim of our time, you know, should or could, you know, deal with this kind of situation. You know, so it's if you take the Ethiopian example, so the best thing is if the people convert, because that also removes any issue of mamzerut. Because if a group of people were actually Jews, getting married, leaving each other, marrying someone else, then you have the possibility of mamzerut because of not giving a proper kosher get, a kosher divorce, the woman remarrying, and actually she's still married to the first man, and so then her children are mamzerim. Whereas if you give a kind of a blanket idea, look, let's consider everyone is not actually Jewish yet, and everybody
will be converted,
and everyone's converted, and then it's all a clean slate, and you don't have to worry. And that was what was suggested by Rabbanim with the Ethiopians, and so
is that what was done?
For some. Yeah. Okay. V'tzarich lehavin. Have you got that? That's like two-thirds of the way down the page. Third word in, and it's in initials. Vav tzarich lamed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. V'tzarich lehavin. Now we have to understand. This idea of unity of the Jewish people, who gam b'meshech kol hashana, it applies the whole year through. Va'ad shemitzvat avos Yisrael, till the mitzvah of avos Yisrael, he kol haTorah kula, is the whole Torah, ve'edach pirushahi, and the rest of the Torah is a commentary on Avat Yisrael. That's what Hillel said, right? The person said, tell me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot. Shammai said, it's impossible, you have to go and learn a lot of Torah, there's no way to reduce it to one statement. Hillel says, yes, what you don't like, don't do to anyone else, that's the whole Torah, the rest is commentary, go and learn. Right, so he ended up saying the same thing, go and learn. But he's got one central statement, and the way the Rebbe takes that is, what you don't like, don't do to anyone else, means Ahavat Yisrael, love of one's fellow. And so therefore, now here comes a stunning line, I must say, when I was learning this over, I was really affected by this. Hainu shekol mitzvah, that means every single commandment, hikmo perush uprat, it's like an explanation and a detail. Be'inyan ha'achdut l'chol Yisrael. In the concept of the unity of the whole Jewish people. So the whole Jewish people, the unity of the whole Jewish people is like the central core of the Torah. And whatever mitzvah we're doing, it is a commentary, it's an explanation of some detail of the unity of the whole Jewish people. It's a fascinating way of looking at it. That is really the centrality of Judaism. And
can you just take us to the original? I can't quite follow the. I can't find, because of the brackets.
I missed out the brackets. Right. That was what was confusing, and I didn't say that I missed them. So let's go back.
Okay.
Va'ad shemitzvat avat Yisrael. You've got that just before the bracket. That.
Yeah.
Now miss out the brackets. He kol haTorah kula is the whole Torah. Ve'edach pirushahu, and the rest is commentary. Now all that. This phrase, Kol haTorah kula ve'edach pirushahu, that's a quote from the Talmud, and number 11 gives you the Shabbos reference. Right. So there's a reference that where it is in the Talmud. That's where you have the discussion between Hillel and this would-be proselyte. And I think in the same passage, it's Erev Shabbos, and this man is trying to get Hillel annoyed, and he can't. I think it's in the same passage. But
is it because of this concept, this principle, its centrality in the Lubavitch world, that the Lubavitch world, that Chabad is so committed to outreach work?
Yes.
This is an organizing principle.
Yeah, I would say that is a central theme of the Chabad's Lubavitch view of life.
Mm.
In the book Tanya, the 32nd chapter, Lev, which is like the heart of Tanya, is about Ahavat Yisrael. It's certainly seen as the, and this phrase here that we have, Hainu Shekol Mitzvah, that means that every commandment, Hikamo Perushu Pchat, is like an explanation and a detail, Be'inyan Achdut L'Chol Yisrael, of the unity of the entire Jewish people. That runs completely counter to the conception of Judaism that I had many years ago. I thought that Judaism was very spiritual, where you study and you come to be on a higher level, and you know more, and you're more pure, and you're more holy, and you don't have to do with people who are, talk in shul. not to mention the ones who don't go to shul. This sort of like elitist philosophy, that was what I thought Jewish life was, in keeping with, lahavdil, the elitism of many other philosophers that I was also involved in, the crowd doesn't understand the, 12-tone music of Schoenberg or the abstract art of Mondrian, so the fools, forget about the fools, they're irrelevant. But
even the sophisticated and the unsophisticated.
Yeah, that's right. The great unwashed and the, the intellectual unwashed. Yeah, well, I mean, look, there are different varieties of elitism. And, it can be a religious, spiritually based elitism as well. And here is this view, which is very striking. Every mitzvah, the power of the mitzvah is the fact that it connects to bonding together the entire Jewish people. And so it might be, you studying Torah, wonderful, you have just made a Siyum HaShas, that's great, that's fantastic, you've learned through the entire 36 tractates of the Babylonian Talmud and you've made a Siyum, that's wonderful. But that is wonderful because you are in that way contributing somehow to the well-being of the entire Jewish people. It's not just you getting a portion in the world to come, it is something which relates to every other Jew. You're somehow lifting everyone up. You climb Everest and you are roped together with everyone else. And so you're lifting everyone else up to Everest as well. That's
very nice.
So, since the unity of the Jewish people is so significant, we've got the question, V'loma mudgash zeh b'mitzvah sukkah davka? Why is it emphasized particularly with the mitzvah of the sukkah? Gam tzarich lahavim, we also have to understand mashakos, what it says lifnei zeh in the verses earlier, as we read, v'lekachtim lechem b'yom harishon, you should take on the first day, priyei tzodah kapas tmorim ba'anef etzovitz v'avinochal, the four types of fruit, the citron and the palm branch and the myrtle and the willow, v'yaduah, and it's known, shemitzvah zu yesh lo shaychus inyan hasukkah. This mitzvah actually relates to the sukkah. Shelechein mitzvah min hamuvcha, there is the idea that the best way of doing the mitzvah, of shaking the four kinds, shenetila dalet minin tiyeh basukkah, to do it in the sukkah. Dezeo gam hashaychu denetila dalet minin lebchinat hadah. Ah, knowledge. This is the connection of the taking of the four kinds to knowledge. Bedugmas leman yedu de sukkah, relating to the idea that we should know as regards the sukkah. As we learn in the writings of Rav Yitzchak Luria, that the kavana that we have when we shake the lulav, hu lahamshich das lenukfa de zah, hu amedis b'chose de zah. It's a little bit,
esoterical.
A little bit esoteric at this point. But what it is talking about is to transfer the flow of knowledge flowing through the system of the Sphira. And so there is the idea of coming down. That lower hay, which you asked, that is the Sphira Malchut. And that's called the Nukva Dizar. That's called the feminine of this system of Sphira. And in some sense, it's at sort of chest level. Now, so the typical way of shaking the lulav, the way the Lubavitcher Rebbe would shake the lulav, was like this. See, he's holding it like this. And see, in each direction, it's like drawing something into one's heart. In a very incredible way. And it's like eliciting from each direction, and then three times, and it's like bringing it into oneself. And so that is this process of internalization, of bringing this intense spiritual radiance from beyond into the person himself or herself. And so the fact of being in the sukkah, the taking of the dalad minim, is of the four plants, is bringing that radiance into oneself. And that's the bringing of knowledge. You see, that's the bringing of something to the level of knowledge, which we're going to explore a little bit more. One second, let's see if I think it'll balance that. Okay, good. Now, okay, so let's take the next passage. Right, so here we're going to get an idea within our own human terms what this process means, because at the moment we're really talking in sort of abstract terms about radiance. It's going to become more tangible, hopefully, in this next paragraph. But Yuvanzer will understand this, behekta meaning hamshochas hammakif bes yashvus, the idea of drawing the surrounding radiance into an internalized form, missing out the brackets, ba'avodat Hashem in divine service, k'moshu hu b'meshech chai adam michlal, as it is in general during the life of a person, val derech zeh, and simli b'chol yom b'yom, and so every day of one's, of the year and of one's life, even though this idea is particularly at the festival of Sukkot, Basukot teshvu, you should dwell in the sukkah, right? Which is the idea of the sukkah, is the surrounding radiance, and dwelling is the internalization. Mikol makom, nonetheless, haTorah klalut uphatut nemra. The Torah is transmitted in a way of generalities and particulars. So in other words, you've got the idea of Sukkot, but that concept really applies every day of the year and every day of one's life. V'yesh me'ein in yanzeh, and there's something like this, gam b'meshech kol hashana, the whole year through, v'ayinin hu. And the subject is as follows. Hine beita in yanim de makif u'pnimi. The two concepts of the surrounding level and the inner level, ba'avodat Hashem bechlal, in general, in service of God, heim, they are, Emuna vahasaga, faith and understanding. That's the two things. So we've got this outer level, this surrounding level of faith, emuna, and then we have the inner level of hasaga. Now hasaga means grasping, like in English. And this grasping means to understand. Have you grasped what I'm saying? Yes, that's the math teacher can say as he's explaining, you know, congruent triangles. Do you get it? You know, you grasp it. So, grasping. Now, grasping means, hasaga, that means that we actually have the concept, that the concept is there in our mind. It's not something we believe in, it's something that we know. It's our reality. It's like the man who, at the beginning of the Hasidic movement, he went to visit one of the great teachers of Hasidism. And after a year or two, he came back, and his father-in-law, who was not a Hasid, was very scornful, and he said to him, so what did you learn by the, you know, the great Magid of Mezrich, or whoever it was he was with? He said, I learned that God created the world. Oh, his father-in-law, ridiculous. He learned that God created the world. He calls over Rivka, you know, calls orphan girl who's living in their house as a maid, you know, they've taken her in to look after her, and so she's working as a maid. Rivkala, who created the world? God. See? Little Rivkala, she also knows that God created the world. So the son-in-law says, yeah, she believes it, but I know it. So that's the difference of faith and knowledge. Faith and grasp, hasagat. So the thing is that if you really know it, that's what you are. You know, that's really where you are, because that is your reality. That's the point where you, you know, that's how you are. It's faith. Faith is an extremely slippery commodity, which the Talmud recognizes. And it says that the thief about to break in calls on God to help him. You know, the frum thief. You know, and the people in the mafia, you know, they go to confession and say, you know, I shot so and so, and I thought, well, you know, save 15,000
million. Yeah, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Yeah, even a Gallup believes in God.
Well, it can be read two ways. You're right. It's good that the Ganef believes in God. Yeah. But on the other hand, that kind of belief has a question about it. Why does that belief allow him to be a Ganef or a murderer or something?
So if it was Hasaka,
right,
then he would be principled.
Absolutely.
And he wouldn't do it.
That's it. Exactly.
Yeah, if the
faith would be an internal quality, he wouldn't be able to act contrary to the reality of what that faith expresses.
You mean if he grasps what God wants of him, then he wouldn't be a thief?
That's right. Yeah. He would live up to it.
No, that's his compromise.
We're all sinners. That there's a sense in which the whole thing for most of us is just like a surrounding thing, you know, and even when we believe in it, you know, and care about it, but very often we are extremely inconsistent, and that inconsistency is what the Hasidic movement, and later on not only the Hasidim, I mean, people realized, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Muslim movement, the ancestor of our host, realized that the problem with Torah knowledge is that it can be a surrounding makif, which does not really affect the way the person behaves. Okay, the person, you know, keeps the rules. If you broke Shabbat in a shtetl in 1850, then no one would buy from your shop, you know, so you have to keep the rules. But the question how you really are living, thinking and doing things, that has to do with this process of internalization.
Ah, you mean everything's the way I'd say that in English is he understands everything intellectually, but he hasn't internalized it.
Right. It hasn't become his or her reality. This is who I am.
Yeah.
This is how I'm going to live.
Can you just tell us about the word hasaga? It's not familiar to me.
Well,
what's the root and how is it used elsewhere?
Well, to lahasig. That's right. Lahasig means to reach or to grasp. Can you reach that place, lahasig et hamakom, or to get something? It's in modern Ivrit as quite. In fact, hasaga is also modern Ivrit. Ain't no hasaga shel ha. You know,
he's got no idea of
something or other. Yeah?
He's got no idea.
Hasaga is attainment.
Oh, I see.
Attainment.
Like the educational system.
Yeah.
Yeah, is that what you mean? Yeah, like Hasaga. Okay. So it's attaining. It's getting to someone. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So this slightly different meaning is grasping. Okay. Mm. So there we have the idea of faith and hasaga, and grasping or knowledge. So utchila tzarich liot inyana makif to sukkah. First, there has to be the surrounding quality of the sukkah. And after that is the sukkot teshvu, that you draw the sukkah, the surrounding quality of the sukkah, into the indwelling in the sukkah. The beginning of service of God is faith. Here comes a nice line. Dochol echad ve'echad miYisrael, every single Jew, miyad sheyatza la'avi ha'olam, as soon as he or she comes out from the womb, right, is born, that moment of birth, into the air of the world, yesh bo b'chinat emunah. This little baby has immediately got emunah. So the baby is born and it's got emunah. K'maymer Razal, as the sages say, she Yisrael hei ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim, the Jewish people are believers, the children of believers. D'zel to'amiti, that's a true description of pi Torah temet, according to the Torah, which is true, shel kol echad v'echad m'Yisrael, of every single Jew. However, this emunah, which we start off with, is not enough. When a person starts being actually conscious and being educated in a proper way, means the age of reason. You know, like the person reaching a age, might be 11. It's the age of chinuch is slightly before bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. It's when a child starts being someone who is thinking, and what you teach the child has reality for that child. And it's a very important moment in the child, in the person's life, because what they learn at that point, that really has defining characteristics for the child the rest of their life. So when a person comes to this more mature, they're not a baby anymore with a kind of an, or a little child. You can't see it in a baby very obviously, but a little child has enormous faith. Children have enormous faith. They're children extremely spiritual. The trouble is, they can do the opposite. You know, like they're also extremely inconsistent. But they do have these, and also they don't necessarily communicate to you the logic by which they see things. You know, they can have a whole logical system. And you as an adult can do something which betrays their logical system. This disturbs them very, very much. Mm-hmm. And they don't tell you about it. So you never know what kind of damage has been caused. But then comes higia lechinuch, an age of greater maturity. What earlier was in a way of faith and surrounding comes in a way of inwardness and settling within the person. Until that becomes the metziut of the person. That's who he is. That's who she is.
The makeup.
These spiritual concepts and realities become what the person actually is. It becomes, like the Kotzker Rebbe said, you know, he's not concerned about what's in heaven. He's concerned what's in the pipik, what's in the stomach, you know, in the guts of a person. That's the question. You know, is the guts of the person something where you have the basic principles of Jewish teaching? You know, it's all very well for these basic principles to be up in heaven, but where are they on the gut level? So, listen, my friends, it's getting late, and we've got here the basic theme of what this discourse is about. So the concept of the sukkah is the surrounding radiance, which is then internalized within the person, and the shaking of the four kinds is part of that process of drawing it within oneself in a way of internalization. And so that is really what Sukkot is about. Now, how is the paradox of this makif, this infinite surrounding radiance, it's a higher level of infinity. How can it be drawn into an internalized inner way? Through the tremendous unity of the Jewish people. It's that unity of the Jewish people which somehow is able to take opposites, like knowledge. Knowledge itself is able to bear opposites. When a person is immature, if something happens against what they want, they get very upset and start crying. But a person of knowledge, of genuine knowledge, is able to see, you know, there are things like that, and sometimes you don't get what you want, and it has to be the other way. And they're able to take opposites, and you're able to take opposites in your human relationships as well. There are people very similar to you, people very different to you, and you're able to bond together with all of them. You can recognize everyone, and you can see a place for everyone, and everyone is part of you together, and you are part of them. That sense of being intermingled. So when there is that sense of achdut, that it's not just one person sitting over here, but it's like in ideal terms, the whole Jewish people there, in some sort of ideal sense, then this surrounding radiance can be internalized within the person, and that's the message of Sukkot. And from that we come to Shmini Atzeret Simchat Torah, when there's this sense of bonding with God through the Torah in this tremendously joyful way. Bezrat Hashem. Okay.
And I wish we meet next week.
Yes, with the help of God now.
You're having a visitor here next week.
Yes, that's right. We're going to bring Nicole.
Yeah.
Bezrat Hashem.